B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
It's another double dose of rock and roll right here on the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Up first, it's Joe Elliott. Of course, you know Joe from his band Def Leppard, but he's also with this band called the Down and Outs. And if you're thinking it's like Def Leppard 2, no. Their new record's called This Is How We Roll, and it doesn't sound anything like, as he calls it, the mothership.
The album to me sounds like it could well have been released 74, 75.
We also discussed Def Leppard's recent Sin City residency this past summer and how much fun he had doing that.
Well, we played songs we've never played before live ever in front of an audience, you know.
Up next, it's former Cinderella frontman Tom Kiefer. His new record's called Rise. It's a very personal record, really good stuff. Has some special co-writers on there as well. We talk about the album. We talk about why it's taken 6 years to record a brand new record.
But at the end of the day, I think over the course of that 6 years, some really a lot of inspiration filled the well for the songs that went into this record. You know, all of these songs, the ideas are new.
We talk about living in Nashville and the influence that may have played on the brand new record. What makes Tom Kiefer proud, as well as his way he likes to tour?
I am definitely a tour bus dweller. I don't like to fly. I never have.
And much more coming up with Tom Kiefer. But first, it's Joe Elliott from Def Leppard and the Down and Outs today on Talkin' Rock.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Hey, thanks as always for checking out the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Another big one for you today with two big acts. Joe Elliott is up first, and of course, Tom Kiefer, as you've probably seen from the description. I'm Meltdown. Al Beck is off to the left of me. What's up, Al?
Hey, not much, man. Just getting ready to get this going.
All right, we got the rock news coming up here with Al after the guys. And today we got an anti-bullying campaign from a bunch of rock heavyweights.
Yeah, that's right. A bunch of guys getting involved in this.
All right, Volbeat had to stop a show the other day. And actually, yeah, did they actually? They never finished the show, did they?
No, they ended up canceling it.
All right, new music from Ghost. We'll talk about that. And also, a rock legend grinding a fan on stage.
Ooh, scandalous.
What?
I know.
So, anyhow, Joe Elliott from Def Leppard is up first. And I got to tell you, this stuff, this Down and Outs, is really good. And it was funny because as I was preparing for this interview, I'm listening to some of the stuff, and I'm like, man, this sounds so much like Mott the Hoople. Then I pull up their website, and Joe Elliott is a huge Mott the Hoople fan. And that's kind of where this band goes. So if you're thinking this is like Def Leppard 2, it's actually not. And it's out right now, and it's a killer record from everything I've heard so far. And so we're going to talk with Joe about that. We got to talk about the residency, about what's going on with Def Leppard, the whole thing. So let's get it started right now. As I was connected with Joe via one of these three-way calls, it's Joe Elliott today on Talkin' Rock. Hey, Joe, how are you, man?
I'm not melting down. I'm all right. I'm in Dublin. It's getting a bit chilly around here, so it's all good.
Yeah, the same thing here in Detroit, but congratulations on the record, Down and Outs. You know, I was listening to this track, and I know this is kind of an obvious statement, but right away, I mean, Mott the Hoople hits me, and it's like, I know that that's a big influence on you, but this is just a straight-ahead, greasy, dirty, grimy rock and roll band, isn't it?
Yeah, well spotted. Yeah, it is. That's exactly what I wanted it to be. You know, I can't see the point in being in two bands that sound identical. It's
right.
Just a waste of time. So this had to be, and that's where it comes from. It's a lot more sleazy. You know, when we first got together 10 years ago, I was basically just hijacking the choir boys. And they are very Stonesy, very Faces, very kind of New York Dolls-ish in there. You know, it's tight but sloppy, tight but loose kind of approach. And that's how I wanted this band to be. And that's what it was for the first two albums. We just did a bunch of covers that were all connected or were actually Mott the Hoople songs. But with the third album, we'd kind of done that to death, so it was time to do something else. But I still wanted to keep that kind of loose, kind of, you know... It's just a little looser than Def Leppard would be, put it that way. And it's more along the lines of a 70s band. You know, the album to me sounds like it could well have been released 74, 75. It's nothing where I intentionally tried to make it sound like it came from after that point of view. This is me, my vision, as opposed to Def Leppard's, which is a compromise. Not a compromise, it's a cooperative, you know, where everybody has their say. With this, it was just me getting my itches out, and the rest of the guys in the Down and Outs more than happy to indulge me on that respect, you know, because they heard the songs, they loved what they were, and they suited their kind of DNA as well, I suppose, you know. And so we have this very very alternative to Def Leppard album, but it's still rock. But it just the distinguishing factor really is the piano. There's not much piano work on Def Leppard songs. On the odd one or two, there is. But for the most part, this is much more akin to, say, Bowie or Elton John in that respect, or Leon Russell or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking when I was listening to some of this stuff. It's really cool. I talked to James Hetfield one time, and I asked him about if he'd be interested in any side projects. He says, well, Metallica kind of is my side project, but I guess I just talked to John Cooper last night from Skillet, who does some side projects, because he wants to drive down another lane, and this is the kind of stuff that you really, it doesn't really fit with what Def Leppard does, so this gives you a chance to go out there and do some other things that you like as well, right?
Yeah, and it's doesn't leave a bad taste in your mouth or anybody else in Def Leppard's mouth. It's, you know, they appreciate and acknowledge and respect me doing this the same way that I do, say, Vivian doing The Last in Line, or Phil doing Man Rays or Delta Deep. Everybody's got their thing. Well, like you say, it's just like driving down a different road. You're always going to come back to the mothership, but it's just nice to veer off and just try something else. And if you write a song, specifically, say, myself, wrote these songs on the piano, I just knew instantly that they just wouldn't work for Def Leppard. And it doesn't mean that I'm thinking that Def Leppard restricts itself. It doesn't. But we want to sound a certain way, and I wanted to sound slightly different to that on these songs. So as much as there's big drums and bass and guitars and some backing vocals here and there, that you could say, well, that's what Def Leppard does. Musically, it's, and sonically, it's a completely different animal.
Yeah, it really is. It's cool because, like, Vince Neil puts out solo records, and they still sound like Motley Crue because he's Vince Neil, but I was really surprised to see how well this stuff sounded unlike Def Leppard, you know?
That was the point. Like I said before, I just don't see the point in being in two bands that sound the same. It's too restricting, and also unnecessary, you know, especially if the songs are good. Why didn't you just save them for the other band? But with this, I think the songs are good, but they sound different. You know, it's like the difference between Phil Collins and Genesis, or Robert Plant and Led Zeppelin. They're both good, but they're very different from each other, and they're both valid, but they're just different, and they coexist side by side.
So, speaking of your other band, you did the Vegas residency. How'd that treat you?
It was great. It was really fun. You know, we did 12 shows over a 3-week period. We never played the same set twice.
Cool.
We threw in some really obscure stuff that we haven't played for many years. Things off High and Dry. We've played some stuff that we haven't played for 25, 26 years, from Pyromania, when we played songs we've never played before live ever in front of an audience, you know. Mm. We really did have fun changing it up every night, and great audiences. It was the biggest production we've ever done. So it was, you know, and we got to sleep in the same bed for 3 weeks.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you had to have like a little bit of a state of continuity going on. You get to stay there and you get to do the same thing every day, but you're switching up the set, like you said.
Well, that's it. You know, you don't get bored in 3 weeks, but you would if you were playing the same set night after night after night after night. And I think the fact that we change up the set every night, that means that when we went into soundcheck, we'd have to play these songs, make sure that we were comfortable to play them that night. So it always gives you a bit of an edge, especially when you don't really make your mind up which songs you're going to play until maybe a couple of hours before you go on. You know, you're like, oh, what are we going to do tonight? There's core elements of the set that don't change, like the intro, the middle bit, and maybe the ending, because there's certain songs that, you know, that, you know, a band like us, you can't get out of the building alive unless you play them.
Right.
But there is scope for in and around the kind of ride areas in a set, you know, where you're going from sequence one to sequence two, if you like, where you can change things out. And that's what we did, and we had a lot of fun doing that.
Hey, so what's in the future for Joe Elliott? I just heard you talking about there's no U.S. dates as far as tour goes with Down and Outs. What's going on with Def Leppard in 2020 as well?
We have a festival in Nashville this Saturday, which is it's a weekend. I think Skinner are doing the Friday. We're on the Saturday night, and
okay.
GNR headlining the Sunday.
Oh, I did see that. Yeah, that's the Exit something or whatever.
311, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's going to be huge. You know, we've got a gig in Sacramento, California on the 2nd of November, and then we truly are done until next year. In which case, that's when I try and scramble the guys out of Down and Out together to do some shows. But like I said, their motherships are very busy too, whether it be Vixen, Def Leppard, or Choir Boys. You know, I have to grab them when they're not working themselves. So I've got to go over the calendar for that one. But I'm just happy right now to get this record out, because the way that the music industry is right now, it's more important, I think, when this record goes to radio, it'll be on the internet, it'll be there for people all over the world who may, you know, if Def Leppard did, if the Down and Outs were to do live shows, we're only going to do a handful, which means that for the majority of the world, they're not going to get to see us anyway. So if we can do a couple of videos, get the songs on the radio, that kind of thing, that really gets the profile of the band across much more than playing live, because we're not going to go out and do 200 shows. It's just not going to happen, because everybody's got real, you know, motherships that they have to get back to that there's big demands on.
Yeah, well, the mothership is, of course, as you know, Def Leppard, and Down and Outs is awesome. I can't wait to pick this thing up on vinyl. This seems to be like what it should be played on.
It's specifically, the track listing works perfectly on vinyl, just so you know. And like I said, it's a very 70s album. It was done for that reason.
Well, listen, Joe, thanks so much for the time. We'll catch you next time you're here in Detroit. Good luck in the future and with the shows and the record and the whole thing. And thanks so much for speaking with us here at Riff.
My pleasure, anytime, bud.
Joe Elliott from Def Leppard on the Talking Rock and Meltdown podcast. The Down and Outs is available right now, and it would be kind of cool to see this band live. But like Joe said, I'm not exactly sure if we're going to see that, because they don't really plan on playing too many dates around the world. But anyways, great record to pick up if you get a chance. Definitely worth that. Hey, coming up here in just a bit, we've got Al Beck with Rock News, as we were plugging earlier. But first, it's Tom Kiefer, and he's got this record out, Rise, which is just so killer. And that's how we start off the conversation today, with me praising Tom on his latest album.
Oh, thanks, brother. Appreciate it.
Now, I suppose, when I listen to this record, I've listened to it several times, so I just love it, but I suppose that every record that you write is personal, but I don't know. This one seems to be really personal. Am I reading too much into it?
They're all personal, and, you know, I think you're just, you know, every record kind of has its own course and path that it takes, from the inspiration that the things that inspired the songs to, you know, how it's recorded. And, you know, I think that the emotion really comes through on these songs and these lyrics, because we, you know, with having toured with this band for 6 years, you know, we all have like this bond and this kind of chemistry between us, not only musically but personally. So I think we were all really relating to the songs, and that really comes through in the performance. So to me, you know, it's, we jumped straight off the bus after 6 years of touring and went straight into the studio and really tried to capture live raw emotions. So I think that really brings the personal flavor that you're hearing alive even more, because we didn't overdub a lot. A lot of these songs are like straight off the tracking floor drums, even up through my lead vocal on some of them are, you know, very live performances, and we tried to preserve that.
So you pretty much, I mean, you're the main songwriter, right? You said you've toured with this band for a long time. You guys are good friends and stuff. What does the band bring to the songs, to the recording, or do you pretty much kind of lead them in the direction you want them to go?
Well, there's two parts to your question there. The songwriting is, I'm not the main songwriter with this band. I've been co-writing since The Way Life Goes pretty much everything with Savannah.
Right.
And then we bring in other writers too. And that's different from the days of the previous records I did with Cinderella, where I did do, you know, almost 100% the writing. So, you know, the kind of partners in crime throughout the two solo records have been Savannah and I, and then we've brought in different writers, particularly on The Way Life Goes. There were quite a few writers that we worked with. On this record, we worked with one of our bandmates, Kendra Chantel, wrote Touching the Divine with us. She's a great writer, and that was a lot of fun to work on that song with her. And we co-wrote the title track with Thompson Square, the country duo, Kiefer and Shauna Thompson. So other than that, though, it's been pretty much all in-house here with Savannah and I. And then the second part of your question, the band, you know, when you take a song and to track it and to kind of arrange it and record it, when you're in a room with great musicians, and particularly ones now, you know, with this band that have a chemistry, you know, I'll just start kind of singing and playing my guitar part or piano part, and
let everybody feel it out and bring in their own parts and colors. And you know, that with this band happened really quickly. There wasn't a lot of discussion in the room or like pulling teeth. It was like they really immediately kind of felt where the song was coming from, and the arrangements and the parts came together and the grooves like really easily, and a lot of really creative vocal stuff, particularly with Kendra and Savannah, some cool stacking and stuff on the record that's different from some things that have been on previous records I've worked on. So we tried to bring out the personality of everyone in the band, you know. We kept the guitars very live. The rhythm guitars aren't doubled and quadrupled. It's like if you listen to the record, Tony's guitar is the one on the left, mine's the one on the right, and you really feel that personality of how we both play. And, you know, we tried to really keep a real live feel to it.
Yeah, I guess when I say, like, you're the main songwriter, I guess I meant, like, you and your wife, because, like, when people say to me, like, you, it's like my wife is, like, my partner in crime, who you met a couple months ago as well, so I didn't mean to leave her out of it, you know.
Oh, no, of course. But, yeah, but that's kind of been the process, you know, and she and I wrote together even before The Way Life Goes, you know. We've been working together a long time, and she's an incredible songwriter, and it's really, really easy to write with her. So it's, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how the process has gone. You know, that's kind of how it goes for every record. You know, you kind of pull these song ideas down out of the air, you get inspired by something, and then, you know, you write the song, but you take it in a very simple form. You know, like I said, when I walk into the studio with the band and we're going to kind of arrange this and now decide what the track's going to feel like, I just start singing and playing, you know, the chords or the riffs that we came up with when we wrote it. And then this band just all fell in, like it was just effortless getting the right feel and parts and stuff for the record. So that was cool. And we were really, you know, on a song like Death of Me or Hype or even, you know, Untitled, the things that really needed that heaviness and that angst, you know. You know, we were all set up in the same room. It was a fairly small, tight, cozy studio where we were right in each other's faces, and it was like headphones on, look each other in the eye, hit record, and say, let's rip this one. You know, Death of Me needs this kind of feel. And then on a song like Demons, you know, I mean, which is almost 100% live off the tracking floor, vocals, every keyboards, everything. You know, it was like, that's all about finding that emotion for that song, you know, which is like a 180 from a Death of Me or Hype. So, and it was really, really a pleasure to do that with this band. I mean, 6 years of touring, you know, we're just a tight unit.
Yeah, you talk about some of these songs, and it's cool to listen to the record. I actually messaged Tony Higbee a couple weeks ago. I'm like, dude, I love the record so much. Just when I think the first side's the best side, I go to the second side. I'm like, no, I like the second side better, and it goes vice versa back and forth, which is cool. But it changes so much, and it's like one of the things I want to ask you is how come you put Rise like in the middle, or how I listen to them, on the start of the second side?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, you kind of, with every record I've been involved with, there's just after the inspiration for these song ideas kind of hit you over the course of just living your life or being out touring, and you kind of store these ideas for the songs, you know, or like the title of the movie or the, you know, the subject of the book, and you know, and you store those along the way and fill in the well with some ideas. And then when you know like last fall when we got off the road, you know, it's like, okay, well, Savannah had a bunch and I had a bunch, and we're kind of looking at the whole pile of ideas, and it's like, which ones really jump out? So like 11 just like leaped out, and they're the ones that we finished. You know, we wrote the rest of the story. We sat down and wrote the song, and then you end up with 11 songs. And when you're done, when you go into track them, you know, you want to have the track feel, present the emotion of that lyric and that that song. And you know, most of the time, if you're writing from that place and recording from that place where you're trying to really do justice to the emotion that the song's about, you're going to end up with 11 songs that feel very, very different. Mm-hmm. So where they get placed on the record is kind of an art in itself, and it, you know, the art of sequencing. and you just kind of listen to them in the right order, because, you know, sometimes a song, you put one song after another song, and like it feels like it doesn't have any energy for some reason, and then you put it after a different song and the energy feels right. So you have to find that, connect the dots of where it feels like the right journey, and, you know, the dynamics come down where they're supposed to and lift where they're supposed to. So in answer to your question, that's really just about what felt best in the sequencing. There's not really a rhyme or reason to it, other than after listening to about a gazillion different running orders, that's the one that felt the best.
So, well,
there's a very long answer to your, but you know, by the end of the recording process, you know, you're not thinking about that sequencing or how different all the songs are going to be when you're recording. You're just trying to do justice to each song. And then you got to figure out what order they feel the best in.
Well, you know me. I'm going to listen to it from front to back, because that's how I listen to records on vinyl, you know, like that, right? So it's like, but there's a large majority, maybe 95% of the people that only listen to it in tracks. But like you said, you take so much time and effort putting it in the right order for only 5% of the people maybe who will listen to it that way.
Well, you know, hopefully not, but you're right. I mean, there are people who are just, you know, and I'm the same way. There's certain records where there's just songs that stand out to me that I like, and maybe the whole record isn't, you know, a full journey. I grew up on records that were that way, you know, listening to the Stones and Zeppelin and all of that in the 70s, you know. So I just still approach recording and making records in that way, where you want a full album of songs where each have something to say, you know, and they kind of go in an order that makes sense.
Yeah, well, this record does make sense when you listen to it from front to back. Like I said, like I've listened to it a bunch of times, and it does kind of have its ebbs and flows, and it's not all heavy, it's not all light, it's kind of, you kind of sprinkle them in there, and it's really cool. With this being your second solo record and stuff, and obviously people know you for Cinderella and whatnot, but with every new record, do you feel like you're becoming more Tom Kiefer and not Tom Kiefer from Cinderella?
Well, I mean, when you leave a band that's as popular as they were, it's starting over. So the first year with the release of The Way Life Goes in 2013, and we started touring, and the band had just come into being at that point, because the first record was made with session players. So the band formed to support that record. We've been together ever since. So there's something that we like about each other. So, but yeah, I mean, it was a process. It's why we toured for 6 years straight, because I think, you know, and it's only natural that, you know, people are going to wonder, well, what's that show like, you know? So it took time to build it. We started in small clubs and they weren't real full. And over the course of staying out there and touring and kind of just spreading the word and showing our wares, if you will, and what this band's about, which is a hybrid of the songs from my past and the new solo material and occasional kind of cool covers here and there that we put our own spin on. It's very similar in terms of performance that you would be used to seeing from me. It's very high energy, lots of sweat. You've seen the show. It's a loud rock and roll show with all your favorite songs. But there's a new energy injected with the band and the new material. So, yeah, I mean, it's taken a few years to kind of, you know, for people to understand what that's about. And the following for the band's been getting better and better. And, you know, now we're doing big festivals and we just made a new record and people are getting turned on to that. So, yeah, it's been a crossfade. It takes a minute. But I think people are starting to, you know, really catch on to what we're about.
Now, with you know, this new record and stuff, and obviously you're a songwriter, you love to write songs and stuff when you're down there in the heart of the country in Nashville, in the heart of music country and whatnot. But what was the deal with it between 6 years? Was it because of the some of the legal issues you had, or weren't you writing stuff? And moving forward, can we expect a new Tom Kiefer record every couple years or something, or what?
Well, I hope so. You know, I think there's a season for every record, and there's, you know, there's certainly been a lot of challenges outside of just normal life that I've had with my voice issues, you know, even with Cinderella records being delayed and legal issues and lawsuits and stuff. And we had a bit of a legal scuff even over the solo record, where kind of in the middle of the cycle working that one. It got pulled from the shelves and some weird stuff, and we almost lost the Masters. So what we decided to do in the midst of that was to keep touring, because, as I said, we were kind of growing the band out on the road. And I would normally never tour 6 years in a row, but since we were developing something new, that's why we did that. So, you know, the reason for the delay, there's multiple reasons. But at the end of the day, I think over the course of that 6 years, some really a lot of inspiration filled the well for the songs that went into this record. You know, all of these songs, the ideas are new, brand new, fresh ideas that came to us between when this band formed and when we recorded the record. So, you know, I always say there's seasons of writing, and then there's the seasons of documenting what you wrote, which is the recording process. And I think there was a season there where we were out enjoying ourselves with this new band and kind of spreading the word and building ourselves out on the road. And while that was going on, we were collecting song ideas from the inspiration of the new adventure. And some of them, you know, some of them had to do probably with some of the challenges we had to overcome. It was disappointing to see what almost happened with those solo Masters, and, you know, almost losing those and having them have a little legal scuff over that. But it's life. So it's hard to say when the next record's going to come. This one, it wasn't quite as long for this one as it was for the Legos. So hopefully the next one there'll be less challenges. And I think we've got a pretty solid band here, and let's keep our fingers crossed we can get to another one quicker.
Yeah, you do have a solid band and a solid record. You know what a big fan I am of all your stuff, and I love this record. My only complaint about this record is that it's too short. It's only like 37 minutes or 40 minutes or something. I'm like working out, next thing you know, I'm like, I hear You Believe in Me, and I'm like, oh man, now I gotta start it all over again.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah. No, it's a great record, Tom. It's awesome.
My very first producer, Andy John's favorite thing to say to me when I'd start getting frustrated, when he would tell me to play something over and over again, you know, he would put on his best John Houseman voice, Andy John's, because he was British and he loved that. And he did a good imitation of John Houseman, and he would say, you know, what we're trying to accomplish here is when the listener gets to the end of the record, they pick the needle up and put it back at the beginning again. I was like, that's very simply put, but now I get it. He told me that on the first record on Night Songs, because I didn't understand what the recording process was like. You know, up until then, we just jumped up on a stage in a club and plugged in and played. And I think we thought when we went in to make a record, that's what we were going to do. But it's a whole different world, man. It's a microscope in there, and it's an art. And of course, Andy really knew the art of it, and I learned pretty much everything I know about making records. But he's right. You know, you want to create something that people want to pick the needle up and put it back at the beginning again. So as simple as that sounds, that's a lot of wisdom in that statement.
Well, there was another English guy who I just talked to a few weeks ago named Gavin Rosdale, who told me, he goes, the sign of a good record is you keep listening to it. And, you know, that's what this record is. I've listened to it several times and I really like it. And not just because I consider you like a friend, but it's like I'm a fan, and I couldn't wait for this record to come out. So it's really cool. I want to switch gears here just for a bit here. So listen, I was watching this this documentary the other day about wrestlers, and it kind of struck me as how much wrestling and rock stars kind of almost live the same life. You know what I'm saying? With the exception of, I guess, you guys putting out records and going on touring. But as far as touring goes, you know, you guys are sound checking, the wrestlers are working out, then you get your hour to play at night. Talk about the grind on the road, maybe back when you were with Cinderella, and what it's like now.
But, you know, touring's, you know, very similar. Not much has changed, you know. I am definitely a tour bus dweller. I don't like to fly. I never have. I like getting on the band with the gang in the band, and, you know, definitely ground routing the shows. And that's the way we did it back then. And, you know, it's,
No, it's really not much has changed in that sense. You know, you book the dates and you get on the band with the bus and walk out on stage and just have that amazing moment with the fans and sharing the music. And it's something that I'm just forever grateful for, you know, to walk out on that stage and hear them singing the songs. And now not only the stuff from Cinderella, but the new stuff as well. You know, they're singing as loud as the old stuff. So that aspect of the business still just feels the same, you know, and I feel really fortunate for for all the people that still come out and fans, you know, it really just means the world to me and to the band.
So what makes Tom Kiefer proud? What would you say is something that you really are proud of?
I'm proud of our band. You know, I think that it's something that just felt like it was meant to be. And sometimes life just hands you those things when you least expect it. And a lot of times it's when you really need it. And that's what each individual member of the band felt like when this came together. We were all at a crossroads or a low point where we needed something. And it just felt like it was that this was meant to be. And like I said, you know, for us to be going strong for 6 years and still just having a great chemistry on and off stage is a rarity. So I'm really proud of that. And I feel really fortunate that came together. And I'm proud of what we just created. And, you know, when I hear, you know, someone like you, who I know has been a fan for a long time, say that you want to pick the needle up and put it back at the beginning again, that's, you know, that's the best compliment that we can hear. So
no, it's a killer record, and it's really something cool. And I'm glad that we got it out and got to hear some new stuff real fast. I know you're playing the Machine Shop coming up on the 15th. I leave for Vegas the next day, so I'm going to come up and see you. And my friend Bumblefoot was just texting me. He told me to say hello. So,
oh, cool. Well, tell him I said hello.
Yeah, he says he's a big fan and he likes your stuff as well. So, hey, I just want to put this out there. By the way, people ask me about this all the time about the cool, you know, the cool guys in rock and roll. And you took care of my wife and my son's girlfriend's parents so well the last time, and I really appreciate that. And it's good to see guys like that out on the road, and I appreciate that.
Well, we appreciate you too. And that was a fun show that night at the fair there that we played the last time I saw you. That was a really high energy crowd, and we had a great time.
Hey, Tom, listen, man, thanks so much for your time. We'll see you in a couple of weeks, and really congratulations on your success of this record, man. It's really killer, and man, I can't wait to see you guys coming up. How many new songs are you playing?
We started touring before the record was released, and we had put three in. We had The Death of Me, Rise, and Touching the Divine. And I, you know, we're planning on touring through next year to support the record. So I'd imagine now that the record's released, we're going to probably start adding some more in.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
And there he is, Tom Kiefer, today on the Talking Rock with Meltdown podcast. Got to thank him and Joe Elliott for taking some time out with us today. You know, I was just talking with Al Beck here. I'm like, man, I'm just not with it today. I'm trying to think of what it is. Oh, maybe because I did a 5-hour bar crawl yesterday.
Oh.
And went and saw Skillet, Alter Bridge, and Dirty Honey. Dirty Honey, man, I'll tell you what, that's a cool band.
Yeah.
Right there. I mean, Alter Bridge. As I talked about on my blog at WRIF.com, I mean, they're just, you know, legends. I mean, Miles Kennedy, he sings so effortlessly, and he hits every single note. And it almost looks like it's too easy for him,
right?
You know. And so Mark Tremonti on guitars, and of course the guys from Skillet come out, and I forgot how like powerful they were. Jen Ledger, the guitar player, or the drummer, I should say, she just bangs so hard. She reminds me of Haley Kramer from Pop Evil. They're just back there just banging away.
Yeah.
And so it's really cool to see that band. So maybe that's why I'm a little bit out of sorts today. I went home and watched the hockey game. I just feel a little drained.
Yeah.
So,
I feel a little drained myself, but that was just cheap scotch at home.
Right, exactly.
Last night.
Yeah, because you spent 13 hours on the couch probably watching comic book movies.
Yes,
or something.
With cheap scotch.
Yeah.
And I'm paying for it today. But back to that Dirty Honey, I had just seen recently that those guys were like, they were the first ever unsigned band to get a number one song in the Billboard charts.
Yeah, not only that, so we're kind of, I was kind of backstage on the side of the stage by the by the monitors, and ready to like do an intro before Alter Bridge came up. And so anyways, I'm standing there and I see the guys from Dirty Honey walk up. I've never met him before. Well, it was such as like a Spinal Tap moment. They couldn't figure out how to get out of the backstage area. Yeah. So but get this. So they leave the backstage area and they go out to their merch booth, which they run themselves.
Really?
Yeah, they've got nobody running it for them, right? So I go out there and run the merch booth. So I'm like, all right, I'm there with one of my friends. I'll go out there and, you know, meet them and say hello and stuff like that. Not because I just met them a few minutes ago. So anyways, I walk out there and Alter Bridge is playing. So we miss a little bit of Alter Bridge's set. We meet them. They're great taking pictures, the whole thing. Then I go out and do the intro for Skillet. It was really cool. And as I'm leaving, I had to get up early and stuff. As I'm leaving, like halfway through Skillet's set, they're still out there at their merch booth talking to fans.
Well, so, that's how they make money these days, man.
That's right. So good for those guys.
Yeah.
All right. So Al Beck is here. He's got your rock news you can use or not. And the first thing is this anti-bullying campaign. Mm-hmm. So fire it up.
Yeah. Obviously, bullying's always been a big issue. And sometimes we see more of it now in social media days. People get really brave behind a keyboard, you know.
For sure.
So,
yeah.
So this musician, Andrew Cole, is putting together the hashtag no joke movement and also a documentary film. And he did get a lot of big names to get some support on this thing, including Ozzy Osbourne, Slash, Steve Vai, Chad Smith. He must have been working on this thing for a while because on the list of names, even is Lemmy Kilmister, who obviously is no longer with us.
Right.
Robbie Krieger, Jeff Goldblum, Jane Lynch, Patrick Stewart, and many, many more as well. So this is some big rockers involved in this thing. The hashtag No Joke is coming out October 22nd digitally and video on demand. And there is trailers online if you want to check it out.
So I'm going to tell you this right now. Bullying will never go away.
It won't.
Ever.
No.
Okay? And I'm not saying it's right. Okay?
No.
But as long as there's people who are like 6 foot three and people are 5 foot two or whatever.
You're really drawing on some experience there, aren't you?
So I was listening to Joe Rogan's podcast. He was talking to Rob Zombie. And Rob Zombie said something interesting. He said, you know, he was bullied as a kid. You know, of course, because Rob's a little different. You know what I'm saying?
Sure,
like,
yeah.
You know, you can imagine
Rob. He wasn't Rob Zombie when he was
right,
in school.
Exactly,
you know what I
mean? Right. And so anyways, he said, you know what? That bullying kind of made me who I am. It kind of enforced my drive. It made me go out there and really achieve what I wanted to achieve. And so I'm not saying it's right. Okay.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. But I'm saying that, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm sure listen, everyone's been bullied some way, shape or form. And there's probably some very famous celebrities who have been bullied and became the person they became.
Like us. No, I'm just kidding.
So, anyways,
we're not celebrities.
Anyhow, I mean, yeah, right.
Maybe helping kids who are bullied learn how to deal with it
you know,
is also part of it. Because, I mean, you can't escape it now. I mean, that's the problem is it's online, too.
It's probably a lot worse, yeah.
You leave the schoolyard, which is where our generations may have gotten bullied. Then you go home and you guys still deal with it.
Well, that's true enough. But back when we left the schoolyard, that was gone. There wasn't no cell phones. There wasn't any evidence of it. You know what I'm saying? Now you start bullying people like online or something. There's evidence. You leave it there. So anyhow, Volbeat had to cut their set short the other day. What's up with that?
Well, this was crazy, too, because they were playing a show recently. This was like last week or something like that. And a fan recounted about how they went out there, opened up with a song, Pelvis on Fire. And then about 30 seconds into the song, Michael Polson leaves the stage, followed by the rest of the band. They come back out, try to restart the set, and then they all leave again. And then they come back and announce that the show has been canceled. And they did release a whole statement, but when you really boil it down, there was two issues. Michael had recently had a throat issue that he was still getting over. Mostly was there, but it was still bothering him. And there was also something wrong with their equipment, their monitoring issues. They couldn't hear each other, so they weren't really able to perform without actually hearing what the other guys in the band were doing. So they had to cancel that show altogether. Obviously, fans were pissed.
Yeah, I saw those guys open up for Slipknot, you know, over the summertime and stuff. But, you know, if your stuff ain't working, your stuff ain't working. Then to top it all off, you know, with the throat issues and stuff like that.
So, right.
You know, anyways, we'll see what happens with that moving forward. As far as another story we're going to talk about is a Ghost and new stuff. People have been asking about new Ghost for a while now. And also a new Papa Emeritus. I have to admit, I love the latest Ghost record prequel, but I'm not crazy about this rendition of Papa. It seems a little too, like, I don't know. It seems a little too cartoonish. I like the last one.
Right.
Because he seemed a little bit more like, you know, evil or whatever.
Sure. Well, Tobias Forge did reveal in a recent interview that Papa Emeritus IV will be leading the band in their new album here. What he ended up saying was he told the interviewer that I just know that person will have the name Papa Emeritus IV. It will be the fourth Papa Emeritus, but who that is, I don't know yet. So that's all we really have is the name. He did also say Ghost will not be touring in 2020 because they plan on entering the studio in January to begin work on the next project.
Okay. All right. And finally today, since we got a lot of stuff going on today,
yeah.
Aerosmith got a couple stories about those guys. So what's going on with them?
All right. So they're going to be getting an award for one thing. I wanted to mention this. So kudos to these guys. They're going to be receiving the Music Cares 2020 Person of the Year Award. And this goes to artists who, you know, kind of are philanthropy efforts and trying to help out humanity in some way or another. Other bands that have received this award, like Fleetwood Mac, Tom Petty, Bob Dylan, Elton John, and the list goes on, of course. They'll be receiving this award in January, just a couple of days before the Grammys, as a matter of fact. But like I said, I wanted to throw that out there because good on those guys, but the real Aerosmith story.
Yes, the real one. This is what we've all been waiting for.
Yes. So caught on film is Steven Tyler grinding a fan on stage.
What?
A fan.
A fan?
That's right. A stage prop fan.
Blowing
wind. It's not a person. But he, in the video, he dry humps it, and he has got some smooth moves. But the real reason this is a story was he posted it on his own Instagram, and two of his daughters saw it and were sure to comment on it.
I think it's both of his daughters.
Yeah, both of his daughters. Well, not Liv.
He's got more than two daughters?
He's got Mia Tyler. In the comments, if you were to scroll down, happened to just write "ew" while her half sister Chelsea Tyler Foster went down later and added "my thoughts exactly." So you've got your dad, your dad is Steven Tyler. I'm sure you've been exposed to some stuff.
Oh man, that's so funny. You know, one of my friends knows him. I think we may have talked about it. So we ever talked about this in the podcast?
I don't think so.
Yeah, my friend was a college roommate of his, and he was also one of the first managers of Aerosmith.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, so anyways, this is about 10 or 12 years ago. My friend says to me, he's like, yeah, I'm at the house here today. I'm getting ready to go to bed. It's like 9:30 and knock on the door, and I open the door and Steven's there. I'm like, Steven, what are you doing? I'm like, whoa, who the hell's Steve? I don't know who Steve. Who are you talking about? You know, Steven Tyler, we're old friends. I'm like, well, Steven Tyler just knocks at your door?
Yeah.
So that was kind of interesting. Yeah. So anyhow, well, listen, man, we got a lot of stuff going on this week as far as the podcast is concerned. If you made it this far, give us a 5-star rating, write a review on Apple and iTunes and the whole thing. We do appreciate that. And Bumblefoot said he would come on the podcast and talk. Of course, he had a big summer touring with the guys from Asia. And yes, it was really cool. He's going off and doing his own thing. Sons of Apollo is coming up, so we got a lot to talk about with Bumblefoot. And then I just talked to John Cooper last night from Skillet, as I was talking about earlier. And John is one of the nicest people in this business. Like, yeah. He's so nice. I got a great interview with him. We talk a lot about the new record. We talk, just about a lot of things involving Skillet. So I'm going to post that sometime toward the end of the week. So anyhow, give your socials.
Al Beck Radio, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
All right, at Meltdown WRIF. Thank you so much for checking out the Talking Rock with Meltdown podcast. Subscribe and check back because we got another big week going on.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.